The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning, everyone. It's nice to see you all. The topic that I thought of reflecting on this morning is the topic of refuge. In my reflecting about this, it feels like this is something that seems to be up right now, the sense of wanting to find safety, security, finding a place to be okay, and you know, the challenge of that right now, particularly in this moment, it feels like with the shelter in place orders beginning to lift, we're each starting to reflect on or think about what do I feel safe doing? How can I keep myself safe? And so the question of safety often in our normal lives is a question of physical safety, of health, of security. And the typical way that we think about going about that is, well, maybe we could say is through trying to control our environment. So control feels like a big piece of what we typically think of when we want to find refuge or find a place of safety or security. We try to control our home life. We try to control what we consume. And this is not necessarily a bad thing or an unhealthy thing to take care with ourselves. It's a part of, in a way, it's a part of an expression, let's say, an expression of metta, an expression of well-wishing for ourselves, that we take care of ourselves, that we take care of our families through supporting and navigating the world through trying to be safe. Expression of may I be safe, may I be happy, may I be healthy. This is an expression of metta. And yet the control piece often is, it's not understanding, I would say, the control aspect of the way our minds typically try to find safety is not understanding or not maybe coming into alignment with the truth of the unreliable, uncontrollable nature, the impermanent, unreliable nature of experience, of the world, of situations. And this unreliable nature seems very obvious right now. This unreliable, impermanent, and uncontrollable in many ways nature of things. You know, we heard about this virus in January in China. And I think many of us, as you know, in terms of thinking about pandemics, you know, we have been through a couple of these kinds of things. And yet it's never gotten this bad, you know? So it's like, you know, maybe we had some kind of complacency in January of oh yeah, it's over there, it's not here. And so I don't know. I mean, I think there definitely were some people in the world, some of the health experts who foresaw the nature of this particular virus and the conditions that we find ourselves in now. But most of us in January would not have expected that our May would look like this. You know, the nature of the change in our lives, in our worlds, what we have control over, what we don't have control over, it's kind of in our face right now. And so in some ways, you know, it's a beautiful time to reflect on refuge and what we think of as security, what we think of as safety, and to see if what the Buddha taught about refuge, what the Buddha had to say about safety and security, might support us in this time. The teachings of the Buddha are so deep and profound, and they really touch our experience of dukkha. You know, this the suffering, you know, the experience of unreliability. That's another word for dukkha. The suffering, the stress, the dissatisfactory, the unsatisfactory nature of experience. This is really what the teachings touch and point to. And so it's a beautiful time for us, with this being so obvious, to ask, you know, what kind of medicine does the Buddha have to offer for this? And it's powerful medicine. But it's also, maybe it's kind of hard to take sometimes, the medicine of the Buddha. It's very counterintuitive. It's not what our minds would normally orient to in terms of how can I find safety. With unreliability, what we think of is how can we find something that's reliable? You know, how can we land on something? How can we control things? And in some ways, what the Buddha pointed to is refuge, is coming into alignment with this very nature of experience being impermanent, unreliable, and uncontrollable. That's maybe not what we want to hear. You know, we want to find some place to kind of land. And yet there is something beautiful that happens when our minds do kind of align with that, kind of resonate with that recognition, not with resignation, not with a kind of like, I guess I have no control, a kind of a resignation like that, but more with a kind of an understanding, yes, this is true. This is the nature of experience, and to understand that we do have some agency, that there is some way to choose and to navigate how we respond. And yet that choice, I think, often in our usual way of thinking of finding refuge, the ways in which we respond, we expect them to have a certain outcome, and that certain outcome may be where we think the refuge is. And the teachings around refuge really point to a different direction, an alignment with understanding this truth, these truths. So this speaks in some ways to the mind that can begin to not resist the impermanent, unreliable nature of experience, but also not collapse in the face of it. I think that's important. It's neither resisting nor giving up. You know, it's not, it's this interesting kind of almost knife edge of taking action and yet not necessarily holding to or needing the consequences of those actions to be what we want them to be in order to be okay. That our okayness, our mental well-being, does not have to rely on what's happening in the world. Our mental well-being does not have to rely on the outcome of our actions being what we think they should be or would like them to be. Our mental well-being can, that we can have a place of peace, ease, at-easeness, well-being, independent of the conditions of the world, independent of how our actions affect the world. And this is actually really good news. You know, if our well-being actually relied on the world being in a particular way, it would not be very hopeful, because there's so much of life and experience that we don't have control over. And so this kind of ease or peace, another word for that, equanimity, the mind that is balanced in the face of pleasant, unpleasant, in the face of whatever conditions are there, a mind that is not reactive, but also a mind that is engaged. It's not indifferent. Equanimity is not an indifferent state of mind. It's engaged and it is connected to these beautiful heart qualities of compassion and love and joy. And so these qualities of equanimity, compassion, love, and joy kind of become our way of acting and responding in the world. And how is this possible? The possibility of coming into alignment with these truths and coming into alignment with this impermanent, unreliable nature. It's quite amazing, actually, when, you know, at times my mind has, my mind definitely still rebels. You know, it's like, no, I don't want it to be like this. And then when I see that and I see the suffering of that, I see the stress and the tension, reminding myself of, this is the way it is. This is the truth. There's something in the heart and the mind that lets go. And the recognition in that moment is that the distress, the vast majority of the distress, I'd say all of the distress and the vast majority of the unpleasantness actually has to do with resisting the truth. There is unpleasant experience that happens in our lives. Unpleasant, pleasant, neutral experience happens in our lives. They kind of come and go. But when we're resisting this nature of the impermanent and unreliable experience, when we're resisting that, the resistance is so painful. It's so interesting how our minds think that resistance is actually going to help us. And this is a teaching of the Buddha that, again, it's so hard to understand, because we've grown up, we've lived our lives with this idea that resisting things that we don't like, fixing them, changing them, that we found some measure of happiness that way. We found some way to navigate our lives and get little moments of okayness in that process. And we think that's as good as it gets. We think that that's the kind of happiness that's the best that's possible. And yet, as we really start to take in the medicine of the Buddha, the teachings of the Buddha, the Dharma, one of the refuges that is a traditional refuge in the Buddhist teaching, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, when we really start to take that medicine in, we see that the very resistance itself is so much of the pain that we're experiencing. And that the alignment with the truth, the alignment with experience, creates, when there can be trust, and this it's a whole journey. This is a whole journey. When the heart can actually trust that it's okay to align with that truth, there's something different that happens. The heart sees more clearly the situation and actually maybe even begins to understand different ways that we could respond that are different from our usual habitual ways of trying to control, but are more responsive out of compassion and love and wisdom. So finding our way to this place of alignment with the truth, this is where the Buddhist traditional refuges in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha come in. And I think it's worth reflecting on this, these three aspects of where to place our trust, essentially, refuge. Typically, what we think of as a place of security is a place where we feel like we can trust. We feel like we can trust being okay there. And so the teaching of the refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha is essentially a teaching about trust. What is trustable? These three, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, One teacher, monastic, Bhikkhu Bodhi, who gave us all the gift of modern English language translations of the Buddha's teachings, the suttas, Bhikkhu Bodhi, talks about these three as being not separate refuges. We think, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha, that we're taking refuge in separate things. But he says that they're really three aspects of the same refuge. The Buddha, I'll just talk about them briefly at this point. The Buddha, we could say, is, there's different ways we can think about refuge in each of these. The Buddha, there's a kind of a conventional way to think about taking refuge in the Buddha, the person who lived 2,600 years ago, who discovered this path, found this path, and taught it. This person, if he hadn't lived, then we would not be here with these teachings. And so there's a kind of a sense of appreciation, of gratitude, at least that I feel for this being who lived and who had the capacity to express what he understood, as he is said to have understood or kind of expressed to himself, wow, this understanding when he became awakened, when he had that understanding of the possibility of being at ease no matter what the conditions, he is said to have reflected, wow, this is really subtle. Nobody's going to get it. Nobody's going to understand this. It's not going to be easy to teach this. Maybe I should just sit in bliss here. And then some other part of his mind Or it said that a deva came to him and said, no, there are people out there that will understand this, so you should teach this. So it's a subtle teaching, what the Buddha offers. And so so this is more the conventional side of it, is kind of an appreciation or a gratitude that he became awakened and that he had the capacity to teach and express it, and that he did. I mean, it's amazing that all of those things came together with this person. But another thing that we can reflect on is that, you know, in terms of refuge for this, and this is more alive for me personally. I mean, I have a sense of gratitude for the Buddha, a sense of appreciation that he existed. But what's more alive for me is kind of the recognition that he was a human being and that this possibility of waking up. And he said this to his monks. He says, it's possible to free your mind. It is possible to experience this place of well-being, no matter what the conditions. If it weren't possible, I wouldn't ask you to do so. So he said it's possible. And he was a human being. You know, he wasn't some god, you know, he was a human being. And he woke up, he found this in his humanness. And it was actually kind of experiencing his humanness that helped him wake up. And that's one way to understand what happened for him, because he did explore kind of transcendent practices of deep states of jhana, and kind of, you know, almost like in some of those states, you kind of separate from reality. You're not experiencing body sensations or, you know, sounds. You're just kind of in a bliss state. And he experienced that very, very deeply. And he is said to, after, you know, he came out of those states, and he says, wow, nothing's changed. There's still the same issues going on. This mind is still not simply okay with things as they are. Like, it takes something to do myself, to get away from it in order to feel okay for a period of time, but it doesn't solve the problem that I'm looking for. And so he began exploring things in a different way through actually looking at the nature of his experience. And so this waking up into our human, lived human experience, this is a piece of how this freedom happens. And this is a capacity we all have. This nature to be awake to what's happening to us as human beings, this is a natural function of our human nature. It's just there, this possibility of being awake. And this is one way to explore or think about a refuge, and has been very alive for me at times in my practice, just like feeling like I can hardly know how to practice, feeling like I, you know, can't make myself be mindful. But then in a moment, in the guided meditation, I actually mentioned that moment when mindfulness returns, that effortless moment when mindfulness returns. That's like the capacity of awareness showing itself to you. And there were times in my practice where that was all that I could know. It's just like I was telling myself, you know, I can't do this practice. I'm hopeless. I'm not able to be aware. And then in a moment I'd take a step and there would be an awareness of the sensation of the step. It's like, wow, I didn't do that. This is a capacity. It's available. And in that moment, there was a kind of a sense of what it meant to, in the moment, take refuge in the Buddha. In the word Buddha actually means awake. And so it's then, in a way, taking refuge in the Buddha is taking refuge in this capacity for awakeness. That's just a part of our nature. it takes some trust to take refuge in that, because what happens when we become awake often is like not pleasant. And so, you know, again, it's counterintuitive to us that this nature of being awake would be a place where there could be safety. Because of our traditional definition of safety is often something like safety from unpleasant experience. But again, the Buddha is pointing to a different kind of safety, a safety not of the conditions in the world, but our relationship to those conditions can be, there's the possibility that our relationship to the conditions can be one of balance, of non-reactivity, of ease, of equanimity. And so the refuge in the Buddha, to me, comes alive with this sense of taking refuge in this capacity that we have as human beings to be aware, to be awake. The refuge in the Dharma again, it has different meanings. One way to express it is what the Buddha taught, the teachings of the Buddha, the practices, the guidance that he offered. And this is actually where a lot of our practice has some traction. If we take in these teachings, if we hear these teachings and actually begin to engage with them, then there is some possibility of seeing how and why that capacity for awareness is useful. The orientation that the Buddha encouraged us, how to be aware. Not simply awareness in and of itself, you know, just being awake to whatever is happening with our usual habitual ways of relating to the world. Even that being aware may kind of be infused with our habitual ways of being in the world, wanting to get things that we like, wanting to get rid of things that we don't like. We can be aware and want to get something that we like. And so the Dharma begins to infuse that capacity for awareness with some wisdom, with some understanding of how to be aware so that the mind can begin to come into alignment with these truths. So the Dharma, the truth and the refuge in the Dharma, you know, and just some simple ways to express it. This is what we talk about as Dharma teachers. This is what we talk about nonstop. There's endless Dharma talks, you know, whole courses taught on the Dharma and what it is, and you know. But a simple way to reflect on the teaching or what this perspective is to bring to this awareness is as a kind of a curiosity about experience happening in the present moment, as experience happening in the present moment. That sounds perhaps like, well, isn't that what you would always do? But the normal way that we're aware of experience in the present moment, aware of experience in the present moment, is in reference to how does it relate to me? What do I need to do about it? How can I control it or fix it or change it or keep it or get rid of it? What does it say about who I am? And so this, you know, this being aware of what's happening in the present moment is usually filtered through this sense of I, me, and mine. And a different perspective that the Buddha encourages is, well, attend to, be curious about experience as experience. There's a teaching that kind of really points to this. The Buddha met a wanderer, Bahiya. Many of you know this teaching. It's beautiful. He met this wanderer, Bahiya, and Bahiya came to him and asked him to teach the teachings in brief. I'll keep the story short and go right to the teaching. And the Buddha said, here's how you should train yourself. In the seen is only the seen. In the heard is only the heard. In the sensed is only the sensed. In the cognized is only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. Essentially saying that when seeing happens, know that it's seeing that is happening. When hearing happens, know that it is hearing that is happening. And it's just hearing. What we typically do with seeing is, again, how does it relate to me? What we add so much. It's not just an experience happening in the present moment as an experience happening in the present moment. And so this teaching really points to that. And including, this isn't about like stopping thoughts, but it is being aware that this is a thought that's arising in the present moment. That's a very different way to relate to a thought than believing the thought and following through on the thought. It's like, oh, this thought arose. Wow, that was an experience that arose in the present moment. This emotion arose. Oh, anger arose. What's it like to feel anger in the present moment? What is this experience? So this is, again, pointing to the human nature, the lived human experience. What is it like to be experiencing life, living itself, in this being? So this is one way of exploring or orienting to the Dharma, the teaching pointing to noticing experience in this way. And what is revealed then is another aspect or definition of the term Dharma, which is the truth or the nature. Dharma, the word Dharma actually translates pretty literally as nature. So what is the nature of experience? The Dharma is the nature of experience as impermanent, as unsatisfactory or unreliable as a place for lasting happiness because it's impermanent. We can't land on any experience that happens and keep it forever. So there's not any reliability in this changing experience. There's no place to kind of land and say, that's it. That's where I'm going to find happiness. And the not-self nature of experience. And so this is another, so we can take refuge in some ways the Dharma, we could say, is the actual refuge in some ways. That's what Bhikkhu Bodhi says, is that these three refuges, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, are interrelated aspects of one refuge. And he relates it to, or gives an analogy of it being like taking some medicine. You need a doctor, perhaps, to diagnose your illness and prescribe the medicine and tell you that it's possible if you take this medicine, you'll get well. So you need the doctor, and that's kind of like what the Buddha is the doctor who has the medicine and says, you have to take this. And the Dharma is like the medicine. We have to engage, you know, we have to actually do this. We have to take the medicine. And the Sangha is kind of like the support, the nurses, the doctors, the family that takes care of us while we're sick. We have to actually swallow the medicine ourselves, but sometimes we need somebody to bring it to us. We need somebody to bring us other things and support us in our journey towards wellness. And so these three play together. They support each other. But we have to take the medicine ourselves. We have to engage with these practices ourselves. And it is a very active process. But what this activity does of being curious, of having that capacity to be awake, orient to experience as experience. So that's the refuge in the Buddha and the refuge in the Dharma right there together. It opens us to actually see or experience the nature of life as impermanent, unreliable, and not so. And in seeing that, in recognizing the impermanent, unreliable, not self nature of experience, our mind begins to, it's like it gets a whole different education about where happiness would be found. It's completely different perspective on it. Because it understands in seeing in person, in seeing in the moment, the impermanent, unreliable nature of experience, our mind gets it. That the usual ways that we've been trying to find happiness are a recipe for suffering. They are a recipe for stress, the pain of clinging, of holding on to. It's a recipe for loss when we lose something we had that we wanted, that we liked, and it goes away. And so as we start to see that it doesn't make any sense to try to hold on to try to control the impermanent nature of experience, to try to create pockets of permanence, that's essentially what we try to do. We create pockets of permanence. We try to do that. And then they fall apart and we feel betrayed by the world, or we feel like we've made some mistake, or we've blown it, we've failed. When those pockets of permanence fall apart, instead of recognizing this is just the nature, this is the nature of experience, this is how it is. And so as we see, as we take refuge in the Buddha, that capacity, and orient to this possibility of experience as experience, we start to see the impermanent, unreliable nature of experience. And that begins to help our mind to shift its relationship and come into alignment more with these truths, come into alignment. We experience in moments what it's like not to resist the truth. And it's interesting because it's like nothing changes and everything changes. The situation is still the same, but our relationship to it, our heart is not constricted. It's malleable. Our heart is flexible and fluid and able to, like, it's like it flows with and around. There's often analogies about water in the suttas, and you know, the it's like our experience is like flowing around things instead of just, you know, butting up against them. And so this is the refuge. And at this point, instead of it being a trust kind of refuge, where we have to kind of have a little bit of faith that this is going to be useful for us, even from early on in practice, we get little tastes of this. We get little tastes of the heart that kind of goes, oh yeah, it's okay for this anger to be arising. it's just this arising right now. We get little tastes of that, and that begins to support our trust, support our confidence. And then the refuge becomes something more like available internally. It's like we know it for ourselves as a possibility. And then the refuge in the Sangha, actually, I thought I would maybe follow this up next week a little bit because, you know, that one aspect of the Sangha is what I said, you know, that you know, the traditional refuge in the Sangha is around the refuge in the monastic community that has carried the lineage of the Dharma for us. A deeper sense of the refuge in the Dharma, in the Sangha, is those people, whether they are monastics or not, who have actually realized something of what the Buddha understood, so that there can be this transmission and sharing, that the lineage of the teachings has carried itself through 2,600 years. And then there's the Sangha as support for us, that, you know, we practice together, and I think we're really feeling this right now, the way in which Zoom meetings like this can help us to remember the teachings and practice, remind ourselves that we are practicing with other people. When we do have an opportunity to come back together again, I think we will really feel that support, you know, the sense and the way that it's supportive to be with people who share this perspective and want to wake up in this way. And so we are supported, and we do feel that support. That's a refuge, in a way, that we have this community to support us. And it's not independent of the Buddha and the Dharma. You know, it is, I really like that medicine analogy to help us. But another aspect of the refuge in the Dharma is that the more we practice, the more we get a taste of the possibility of being okay with things as they are, with alignment with the nature of things as they are, alignment with that. The more we get a taste of that, the more we can become a refuge for others, that we are the support for others. And that's a beautiful gift back to the world. And in many ways, I think our practice, we actually can't just do this practice for ourselves alone. We don't practice in complete isolation. Even people who go off, the monks I've met in Burma who isolate themselves in caves, this one monk, you know, they need to have visitors come to feed them and speak with them, and I've been so inspired by some of those people. And so we don't practice in isolation, and that person, that one monk that I'm thinking of right now, you know, he practices in solitude, and yet he has inspired me so much that I feel like the people that he inspires through meeting with them in his environment, they go out and they carry some of that. And so we can't just practice for ourselves, and we share our inspiration. We share our Dharma. And boy, the world needs this right now. So that's what I thought I'd talk about next time, is becoming a refuge, becoming a support for others. So that's time. I didn't think I would talk that long, but I'm happy to stay on for another couple minutes. You know, you're welcome to drop off if it's time for you, but if there's any comments or questions, I'm happy to stay on, but please feel free to leave if you wish.